Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Would you believe tanker oil spills depend on what day of the week the oil is being shipped? The Saturday Effect this time on the Environment Show. Stay tuned. Also this week, the United States imports more and more oil. One research professor is perfecting a fuel you can dig up in your garden. Also this week, even small changes in global temperatures could have dramatic effects on inland rivers, such as the Rio Grande, says wildlife biologist Manuel Moles.
It's been estimated that a 10% reduction in snow and rainfall, precipitation, in the Rio Grande Basin would reduce flow in the Rio Grande by 75%.
That story this time on The Environment Show. Stay with us. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. Of all the major oil spills each year, 163,000 gallons are lost in U.S. waters on Saturday of any given week. Stumbling upon this statistic quite by accident, Dr. Eben Goodstein calls the phenomenon the Saturday effect.
It turns out that certain types of oil spills, tanker oil spills, occur much more frequently on Saturdays than one would expect if you just thought they were would occur randomly throughout the week.
And in your research, did you come across any reasons as to why Saturday was particularly more of a hazardous day for transporting oil?
No, I didn't. I was able to rule out one hypothesis, and that was that tanker accidents occurred more frequently on Saturday due to an increase in traffic. It turns out that tanker traffic is pretty constant throughout the week, so it wasn't just a matter of more vessels traveling on Saturday.
The Exxon Valdez grounded on a Thursday, but what have been in the history of oil transport, what have been some of the major spills that, in fact, have occurred on Saturday?
Well, if you go way back to 1967, the Torrey Canyon, which is one of the first big oil spill, kind of shook up the world and let people know about the potential problems associated with transport. That was a Saturday spill. More recently, the ARCO Anchorage spill off the Port Angeles, Washington, and the Presidente Rivera on the Delaware River in 1989. Those were the three most famous spills that were Saturday spills.
Goodstein is an assistant professor of economics at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York, and he has some theories as to why Saturday is the day. The spills he studied are those caused by vessel guidance accidents, groundings, collisions, and rammings, for example. He says discovering this phenomenon was something of an accident itself.
I actually stumbled onto the finding. I was trying to determine the impact of oil spills on the stock market value of the firms involved in the transport. When I noticed that, in fact, a lot of the time the spills were happening, the market was closed. It was a Saturday. And at that time, I was working with just a listing of spills reported in the New York Times. I checked it out, and indeed, there was a big Saturday effect. So I moved on to another listing published by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, and found another Saturday, a strong Saturday effect there. So I thought, well, this is really interesting. And got a more comprehensive listing of oil spills from an organization called the Oil Spill Intelligence Report. And they're in the business of tracking oil spills. And they have a pretty complete listing of all the spills worldwide over 10,000 gallons since 1978. So that was the most comprehensive data set that I worked with.
As often happens with a study such as this, there is no firm conclusion as to the causes of the Saturday effect. Goodstein does say, however, somewhat off the record and unscientifically, that the cause may have to do with what he calls cultural habits.
I would say that the obvious suspect here is substance abuse, certainly what springs to most people's minds if you're talking about a Saturday effect. But I would just want to stress that I really have absolutely no evidence to suggest that that's what's going on. One Harbor pilot I talked to said that, maybe it's not alcohol abuse, but just sailors staying up late on Friday night playing cards because it's just a cultural pattern. So I don't really have any evidence to suggest that that's what's going on, although it certainly seems like a plausible hypothesis.
In fact, the Saturday effect seems to be limited to Europe and the United States, which, says Goodstein, makes sense if his cultural theory is correct.
If you're talking about some kind of cultural phenomenon, some weekend influence, then you wouldn't expect a Saturday effect in Kuwait, for example, where our equivalent of a Saturday is actually on Thursday. It's not a worldwide phenomenon, but it does seem to be relevant to Europe and North America.
To avoid the Saturday effect, one obvious solution would be not to ship oil on Saturday. But Goodstein does have some other recommendations to make in light of this discovery.
I mean, the primary value of the research is just to bring this Saturday effect to the attention of oil transport companies and insurers, because they're the ones with the most obvious incentive, direct incentives to deal with the problem. So I'd hope that just by bringing it to their attention, they could take steps to try and find out, you know, what's going on, alert their crews to be more careful, or try and discover, if they can, because they're the ones who have the information, really what does lie behind the Saturday effect. I analyzed a few possibilities. One would be the companies directly affected dealing with the problem. Another possibility would be the insurers, who are the ones really with a financial stake in this issue, setting up appropriate incentives for the transporters to deal with whatever it is that underlies the Saturday effect. And then if the private companies don't deal with it, the insurers don't deal with it, there may be some role for harbor authorities I discuss the possibility of harbor authorities attempting to, restrict Saturday traffic in some way, if necessary.
Goodstein says one problem with imposing restrictions, the solution could backfire. If a pilot knew the ship was running late to get into port before the Saturday curfew, he or she might take additional risks, such as increasing the speed to get in under the deadline, and thus increasing the risk of accidents and spills. Dr. Eben Goodstein is an assistant professor of economics at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York. He presented his findings at a recent meeting of the American Economics Association in New Orleans. And this is Bruce Robertson. Most Americans use sugar beets every day and don't even realize it. This Midwestern crop is turned into granulated sugar found in food and our morning cup of coffee. But one researcher says we should try using sugar beets in our gas tanks. Professor Thomas Tornabene of the Georgia Institute of Technology is perfecting an improved system that turns sugar beets into ethanol fuel. So far, he's tested his findings in Brazil, where the majority of cars burn alcohol. There, he developed a plant which makes the yeast cells more efficient in their production of alcohol from sugar.
Well, when you take these waste streams like the sugar streams, there's a lot of organic material that's remaining, sugar that's in the waste stream. So we were taking that kind of material, we were mixing them with river water, actually, down there, and we were putting them into large canisters that we had designed to handle this kind of material. And what we did is we took special strains of yeast that we had developed and we attached them to a support matrix like a clay pipe. And we call this, and when they're attached, we call this immobilization. So we immobilized the cells to the type of clay pipes, and we set them up in special recycling systems where we could mix them. We found that we had to aerate them. This is unusual for an anaerobic system, that is a system without oxygen, that you had to aerate the cells just enough for them to make the kind of cellular chemicals they needed to make high alcohol production.
Tornabene's system of fermentation forces the yeast cells to continuously produce alcohol. That's because the cells are trapped in the cylinder or bioreactor where they can be used over and over again for fermentation. His pilot plant in Brazil, which was built in 1989, has fermented sugar into ethanol nonstop for months at a time. Tornabene says he developed what he calls the bioreactor because he wanted to make ethanol production more efficient. He calls the most common way to produce ethanol the batch approach.
One of the problems with alcohol systems, I think worldwide, is that you'll get investors and you'll get certain engineers who know the engineering process, but who do not understand the biological process very well. And they have this, it's like a farmer's approach to a system. You dump everything in a big vat and you let it cook, so to speak. And then you wait for the product to come out. Well, you find that the product coming out is pretty good, but you're not getting the best use of your raw material that you're putting in, and you're not getting maximum production. So one of the things we had to do was to come up with systems where we knew exactly what the yeast cells were doing. We monitored them constantly, and we found that we could make markers so that they would have maximum production levels.
Tornabene says fuels produced biologically, like ethanol, are the best choice for the immediate future. But much of the alternate fuel research currently is focusing on genetic fuels or elemental fuels, like those made of hydrogen, an element. Instead, Tornabene argues, investors and researchers alike should be trying to redesign and improve a system that already works, fermentation.
Someone has to step back and support the new designs of systems to be built. What we're doing is we're letting entrepreneurs using old concepts in which to build these fermentation systems. And there are better ways of doing it, but it's going to cost money. And so that initial investment has to come from somewhere.
Tornabene's process improves efficiency by 10%, which saves 28,000 tons of sugarcane a day in the Brazil pilot plant. Plus, Tornabene maintains 100% of the waste product from ethanol production can be recycled.
There's many things you can do with it. You can add it on to solid materials and feed it back to the cattle. We take all the mineral water that's coming off of this after fermentation, we put it back on the fields for fertilizer. All the minerals and so forth come back. It's an excellent recycling. It saves the ground for a much longer period of time. See, a fermentation product, a natural product like that, is a much better waste product that you can reutilize.
But surprisingly, Tornabene does not see waste-to-alcohol fuels as the solution. He points to the regulation of the sugar beet market as one problem, which prevents a surplus and lower prices. So, some sugar beets would have to be grown just to be used as fuel. This, along with the inefficient fermentation systems used, is also the reason the price of ethanol is not competitive, about $1.50 a gallon. And, right now, most of the ethanol in the country is made with corn, which is more difficult to convert. So, Tornabene predicts ethanol will become obsolete unless there is a fuel emergency.
In my opinion, in the United States, if we do not have an economic siege of some nature that will force us into it, it will never happen. I think that we will be able to keep going on the kind of systems we have until there's a major breakthrough in alternative fuels. Maybe the battery system will take over. Recharging systems may take over. Natural gas may take. It depends upon the locality of the country. Each of them may have different systems. I could visualize here, you're driving from New York to San Francisco, and you may be using a natural gas coming out of the eastern part of the United States, where you would get into central United States and use some ethanol or methanol systems, where you would then go further west, and then you would change to another fuel again. So you'd have to have an all-purpose fuel engine.
If alcohol is ever used, Tornabene sees it as only a temporary solution. He does not predict any fuel will be as significant in the American lifestyle as petroleum products have been. But he looks to the lack of a dominant fuel in the future as a constant encouragement for the development of better products. Professor Thomas Tornabene is a researcher in alternate fuels and the associate dean at the College of Sciences, Georgia Institute of Technology, in Atlanta. This is Bruce Robertson. After 5 contentious years of negotiations, the Uruguay round of meetings on the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, better known as the GATT talks, apparently have failed to achieve anything. The discussions, which began in Uruguay, ended in December in Geneva on a sour note. At issue now is farm subsidies. Europe has more, the United States has less. Eve Hamilton is a research specialist and a writer at the Overseas Development Council in Washington. She says the 108 participating nations need a GATT agreement, not only for economic health, but for environmental survival.
What we've got right now is a system in which the supports and trade barriers in developed countries really limit the developing countries to, say, a few different products or commodities that they can export. What that tends to do is mean that if they're only producing, say, one or two or three commodities, they're going to overexploit their resources. They're not going to be using crop rotation, which tends to minimize erosion. And in many cases, in fact, the commodities that developing countries are stuck with as cash crops are environmentally harmful. A couple of the main crops are cotton, cassava, cattle ranching is one of the worst, but these are the primary cash crops that are open to developing countries, and they're very harmful to the environment.
These crops and products are popular precisely because they are the easiest to turn from raw material to cash. But a vicious circle is spun here, whereby the economy gets used to the quick cash for which it needs an ever-increasing supply of the quick raw material. And as that raw material gets harder and harder to procure, efforts to get it become wilder and wilder. Hamilton says the GATT agreement would be the brakes needed for this runaway locomotive.
Trade liberalization would open up markets for developing countries. Hopefully in the non-traditional exports, which would allow them to diversify their agricultural sectors, potentially into some less environmentally destructive commodities, such as fruits or vegetables or cut flowers. But unfortunately, a lot of the non-traditional exports are not being dealt with in the Uruguay round, so they would have to be dealt with in separate trade negotiations. But it would also, I think, create an environment in which sort of long-term planning makes more sense for developing countries. Right now, you've got a situation where agricultural prices on the world market are very low, and they fluctuate. It's just simply not a stable market, and that's not really conducive to long-term planning. Long-term planning being important in that you want to use your natural resources carefully today in a long-term perspective, so that you'll have them to use down the road and continue to have exports and be able to feed your people. What I think they do now is to overexploit their natural resources today in order to respond to what the market says today. They don't know what the market is going to be like tomorrow for any given commodity, so they have to take advantage of it and overexploit their resources now.
With GATT stabilizing the world economy and the cycle perhaps broken, new balances could be struck.
What will come about with the trade liberalization is that you'll have a shift in production, agricultural production, from the north or the developed countries where it is now to the south or the developing countries, which is where it should be. This is, you know, the labor-intensive countries who can produce a lot of the agricultural commodities at a much cheaper level than what the developed countries are doing. And that will bring, obviously, financial resources to these countries. And we're talking about, I think, significant sums of money. The U.S. protectionism in the sugar industry alone, and sugar is a very important cash crop for many developing countries, that protectionism costs these countries roughly $800 million per year. We're talking about one industry and one year. So I think that obviously the potential for helping out their economies is significant if you have a broad-range liberalization.
Eve Hamilton edits the Policy Focus series on U.S. and Third World issues at the Overseas Development Council in Washington, D.C. This is Bruce Robertson. The character of the Rio Grande River in New Mexico has changed a great deal over the years. Once a free-flowing river bordered by prime wildlife habitat, the river has been harnessed by dams and irrigation ditches as demand grows for water in the arid Southwest. Besides the loss of its uniqueness, these changes also threaten natural river ecosystems and other traditional uses of the river that have gone on for centuries. But as Kent Patterson reports, some people are now taking a second look at the future of the Rio Grande.
Every winter, the Rio Grande Valley hosts migratory birds from the Arctic and Northern Plains. Here at the Bosque del Apache National Wildlife Refuge in central New Mexico, sunset is marked by huge flocks of snow geese and sandhill cranes. But urban and agricultural development has altered the habitat of waterfowl and other wildlife. University of New Mexico biology researcher Manuel Moles says migratory birds are increasingly confined to refuges like Bosque del Apache.
So what we've done is to concentrate the wildlife that depends on wetlands in a few places along the Rio Grande, whereas historically it was diffused up and down the whole corridor of the river and much more spread out across the center of the state.
Once a free-flowing river, the Rio Grande's waters are now harnessed by irrigation ditches, dams, and flood control projects. The river's woodlands, known as the bosque, are being invaded by competitor plants such as salt cedar and Russian olive. According to Albuquerque Nature Center manager Karen Brown, the bosque's cottonwood tree population is being reduced by dams, which prevent the spread of the majestic tree seedlings.
Since the flood control measures were put in and the dams were built upstream, this area has stopped regenerating. Cottonwoods have stopped regenerating on their own.
North of Albuquerque is Cochiti Dam. Built in the 1970s, the dam flooded lands belonging to the Cochiti Pueblo tribe. First the home of Native American and later Hispanic farmers, the Rio Grande Valley today is managed by a patchwork of government, agricultural, and industrial interests, and all seek water. Some contend that competition over Rio Grande water is leaving traditional users out in the cold. David Lujan is the director of the Tonantzin Land Institute, an Albuquerque-based advocacy group for Native American and Chicano land-based communities.
The Bureau of Reclamation came in and played havoc on traditional communities. We have the conservation district that has caused people not to, you know, they don't understand what their water rights are anymore.
But the future of the Rio Grande won't be entirely decided by regional projects. Manuel Moles and others are studying how possible global climate changes could affect the river. Since the Rio Grande's flow is largely dependent on snowpack melt from the San Juan Mountains in Colorado, less precipitation in the mountains, adds Moles, would limit the flow and set the stage for intensified competition in the water-hungry Southwest.
It's been estimated that a 10% reduction in snow and rainfall precipitation in the Rio Grande Basin would reduce flow in the Rio Grande by 75%. So sort of the bottom line is that in arid and semi-arid regions, small changes in the amount of rainfall will result in large changes in surface flows in rivers like the Rio Grande.
A growing number of people are advocating careful, planned use of the Rio Grande's resources. One important campaign was launched this fall by New Mexico Senator Pete Domenici. Dubbed the Rio Grande Bosque Conservation Initiative, the plan seeks to preserve agricultural, wildlife, and recreational uses along a 150-mile stretch of the river in New Mexico.
That report, produced by Kent Patterson for the High Plains News Service, a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils in Billings, Montana. And that's our show for this week. Our piece on sugar beets was written and produced by Karen Kelly. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, number 106. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer, and this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.